poof, gone. 20% of your money vanished into thin air. If you only invest in stocks and bonds, that's what you're looking at, according to the geniuses at Goldman Sachs. They say real assets are key to salvaging those 20% losses. Real assets like contemporary art. That's right. The same kind of art you see on the walls of museums. This art has outpaced the S&P 500 by more than double for the last 26 years, and it performs even better than real estate and gold when inflation is this high. One company has even beaten those numbers. They're called Masterworks, and they've averaged a net return of 29% to investors from just 6 exits. Even through COVID, a bear market, and sky-high inflation, some of you early adopters who already signed up saw their exit in August for a 33.1% return. That's right, 33.1%. Obviously, with numbers like that, demand is surging and there is a wait list. But you can skip it just by going to masterworks.io/sad truth. That's masterworks.io/sad truth. See important regulation A disclosures at masterworks.io/CD. That's masterworks.io/sad truth. Hey guys, I am so excited today to have one of the most photogenic guys on TV. As good looking as me, I don't know, probably taller than me. So he makes up for the looks by being taller than me. But then again, other than Greg Gutfeld, many people are taller than me. How you doing, Will King?
I'm good, Gad. How are you today?
Good, good. I'm so excited to talk to you because I think there are so many things that we have overlapping interests. Of course, all the sports stuff, all the woke stuff. But what I thought we'd start off with today you have a very, very interesting and, non-conventional, career path in that you were first, you studied telecommunications at Pepperdine, then you went and got a law degree, you're a lawyer, but then you decided you didn't want to pursue law and you went into media. I want to talk about your water polo career in a second, but tell us how that trajectory happened. Serendipity or well thought out? What do you think?
In the beginning, I would say serendipity, and then it manifests into calculation. When I was in law school at the University of Texas, I realized that I would probably be happy being a lawyer. My father was an attorney, a small town attorney in Texas, and I idolized my dad. I loved going to watch him in the courtroom or even sitting in his office and watching him talk to clients or opposing counsel. And I went to law school because I wanted to be a trial attorney. But when I was in law school, and for what it's worth, I loved law school. I feel like I got a lot out of law school, more than I did out of my undergraduate degree in broadcast journalism. But when I was in law school, I realized pursuing this as a career probably felt like hitting a double. And the way that I was raised and the way that I'm engineered, I need to see the fence so I know how hard to hit the ball. And I wanted to at least go for a home run in terms of my dreams. So after law school, I packed up my dog, beautiful Doberman Pinscher, and I drove north. I drove to Montana, and I lived in Montana for what amounted to a year. I ended up working on this hunting ranch, and while I was there, I wrote the great American novel that went absolutely nowhere.
Now, but why did it go nowhere? Did you write it, but you couldn't sell it, or what? Where was it in the process?
I did. I wrote it. I finished it, which truthfully is an accomplishment in and of itself to complete a novel. And I went through the editing and revision process as well. It's not like I just threw down a first draft and then said goodbye. I spent a couple months going back through it and editing it. I got an agent, but it didn't ultimately sell. But, I knew that when I was in law school, I had this little kindling of a fire that I wanted to be in media. In the beginning, that meant my voice would be shared through fiction, and I had read two books that really influenced me. One was Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry, and the other was Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck. And in Travels with Charlie, Steinbeck says, if you took a boy from Washington, D.C. and said to him, hey, would you describe for me Texas? And I'm a big lover of my home state of Texas. But that boy would in actuality describe, Gad, Montana. So I thought at the end of law school, well, I'm going to go to this place that is, in essence, what should be Texas, and I will write The Great American Novel while I'm there. And it was a wonderful year. I did write the novel, as I mentioned. I worked for this wonderful, long-term, generational family in Montana as a hunting outfitter. And it's one of the best years of my life. While I was there, my father died suddenly, and I'm the oldest of four. So it was time to grow up, and it was time to come home. And I did. I went back to Texas. My youngest brother, who's 10 years younger than me, was still in high school. I moved back to my hometown. And then I started to really turn this desire to be in media into an entrepreneurial venture. And for me, that meant I was ready to go into the newspaper business.
So, but what drove you to the media? I mean, is it that you thought you had important things to say that didn't pan out through your, you know, nascent writing career, and therefore that's the next conduit by which I can have my voice heard? What drove you? What compelled you to be a media person?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how you led that question. Did I have a burning desire to have my voice heard? You know, I was thinking about this morning, Gad. In the most recent episode of the Will Cain podcast, a shameless little plug,
please.
I had Michael Schellenberger on the podcast, and we discussed that nobody wakes up every morning, Gad, and looks in the mirror and says, today, I'm going to be the bad guy. So how do we analyze the motivations of those who share a different worldview? And I was thinking about this morning after that conversation, and I truly think, as in everything in life, there's a balance. But if you had to point the one human characteristic, the one human trait that leads people down a path that can eventually be termed evil, it's arrogance. I truly believe that at the root of most problems is arrogance, most likely in the form of narcissism, which is this horrible cocktail of arrogance and insecurity that manifests into narcissism. And you asked me, did I think my voice had to be heard? So if I'm being real, and I think anybody in journalism has to start with this reality, there's a little bit of arrogance in the idea that the world should hear your voice. And I did think that probably in some way, Gad, starting back with my pursuit of the law. I loved argumentation. I loved persuasion. I loved trying to figure out how things worked. And once that I thought that I had figured it out, which I'm sure, you know, in all self-awareness, I was just as often wrong as I was right, I felt the need and the desire to share what I had learned. And so, yeah, I think there was that, you know, philosophical motivation. And then I'd add this. While I was in Montana, I read, quite honestly, a lot of Ayn Rand. And I read the biography of a man named Al Newhart, who was the CEO of Gannett and started USA Today newspaper. And with that, I decided that I would merge my desire and love of philosophy, my love of argumentation and persuasion, and my love of the media. And when I moved back to Texas, it set me on the path of being in newspapers.
What do you think of, I mean, I think I know what draws me to guys like you or Pete Hegseth and so on. But, well, I guess let me say it and let me get your reaction. I think you both come across, and I only mention you both because I think you co-host Fox and Friends Weekend together, correct? So
yes.
We kind of see you oftentimes together. I think there is a authenticity that comes out. I mean, the camera really doesn't lie. I know it from my experience in front of the meet, you know, in the spot, you know, in the public eye, where people sit there and are able to pick out, you know, a micro cue that you might have exuded, you know, on the Joe Rogan show that you thought that maybe nobody noticed, but they pick it up. And so I think, would it be correct to say that probably of all of your many wonderful skills and tools, maybe authenticity might be number one?
But that had to be, this is going to sound so weird, but it didn't have to be learned yet. It had to be prioritized. Hmm. So, you know, we went quickly past it, but I did major in broadcast journalism at Pepperdine. So, you know, I had this love of the law and argumentation, but the other half of my influence came from my mother, which every morning she had on the Today Show. And, you know, watching the Today Show over breakfast every morning and reading the back of a cereal box, I probably ended up somehow placing mass media and influence near the top of my list of dreams. And so then I go to Pepperdine. I want to be in sports media originally, and then later news media. But in learning that in university, Gad, I felt like I was going to school to become an actor, and I didn't love it. In fact, I really disliked it. I felt like I was learning to be fake. And that's why I transitioned and went off to law school. And so when I came back to media, which now is after a couple entrepreneurial iterations of my career, when I came back to media, I watched what was being produced. And again, probably arrogantly said to myself, I can do better. And the way that I can do better is by being real, is by being authentic. And then so, when I came back, I had to prioritize that quality and that characteristic. And whether or not that was at CNN or ESPN or now at Fox, I was just committed to doing this in a way that reflected me. And what you see on TV with Hegseth is really rare. And with Rachel Campos Duffy, my third host, which is that it is authentic friendship and chemistry. I think this business creates probably two versions of people. Really, really good performers, and that is not authentic, or good chemistry-based, authenticity-based individuals. Those are the people that really truly stand out and succeed. There is, of course, a mass gap in there that fills most of media with some kind of mediocre, lukewarm soup in between.
Yeah, I mean, I recently appeared for the second time on Megyn Kelly's show, and she's been on mine once as well. And of course, she used to be at Fox. She also oozes authenticity, and people say, you know, we oh, when I appear on her show or vice versa, oh, there's great chemistry. I think what drives that chemistry is that tango of authenticity. I think we both present ourselves to the world with all our qualities and faults, and there you have it. As Martin Luther said, "Here I stand," right? And I think that is such a attractive quality because you can trust the person, right? Because you know that they're not. By the way, just to speak of trust, one of the things that where I build trust with my students is, and you were talking earlier about arrogance and narcissism. If a student asks me a question that completely stumps me, I don't try to wing it. Now, technically, I could easily do that. I'm the professor, the all-knowing professor. I can wing something and you'll probably never know the difference whether I was BSing you or not. But then some 21-year-old kid says something that I say, wow, what an amazing question. You know what? I really don't know how to answer that. Why don't you send me an email reminding me of that and let me look into it? And I see that right there, I got them because they know that I'm not going to BS them. When I know, and I will share that information with all the self-assuredness that comes with knowing something. And when I don't know, I will have the epistemic humility to say, you know what? I don't know. You got me. So I think that's such a wonderful. Can we breed that into people, or do you think that's just an innate quality? You either have it or you don't.
I think it is part and parcel with the. I think you'll answer that question when you answer the question of whether or not you can build confidence in an individual, because I think it's a fruit of the tree of confidence. So, by the way, on this note, he doesn't need more flowers thrown at his feet, but this is what is attractive about your frequent podcast partner, Joe Rogan. Joe's not a particular expert in anything beyond MMA, but what he is authentically curious.
Bingo.
And beyond that, I used to say this, it's interesting that the brand carries a lot of weight in what somebody thinks of you. So now I'm attached to a brand in Fox News that has much greater weight than the brand of Will Kane. So there's a lot of people that simply will not listen to me because of what they feel about the brand of Fox News. When I was on ESPN and I had my own show, The Will Kane Show, one of the things I said to people was, I'm going to be honest with you about my biases. I'm going to be honest with you that I hold opinions and that these opinions influence how I see the world. I'm not going to pretend objectivity. I think that's what a mistake too much of media makes, that somehow you're the voice of God, that you're Edward R. Murrow. And Edward R. Murrow wasn't Edward R. Murrow. Nobody is truly objective, but what you can be is authentic and honest with the audience about your own opinions and biases. And then from there, put forward as good-intentioned, good-willed, and effort-filled try to hear those who would disagree with you. And then somewhere in that process, you hope to hone in on the truth. So that's being honest about what you don't know, being honest about your own opinions. I think Megyn Kelly does a good job of that, as you describe. And then somewhere in there, you earn the trust. And that's the key here. You earn the trust of an audience that has rightfully increasing amount of skepticism. The audience needs, honestly, the audience needs trust more than they need the pretense of a lack of bias.
So if you were to compare, I know you also worked briefly at CNN. CNN would be a manifestation of the opposite of what you just said, which is they pretend to be authentic and non-biased and objective when we clearly know that they're not. Whereas I think Fox does a good job in saying, look, we do have a particular political position. That doesn't mean that we won't invite people of opposing positions, but we are going to properly signal that we hold these particular views. Is that, you think, the key difference between Fox and CNN?
I do, as two particular examples. I do. I think if you looked at who has, and I don't like these little media pissing matches, but if you looked at who invites and hosts people of differing opinions on more, I'm pretty confident in how that ratio will work out for Fox.
Well, I'm while obviously some people might think I'm slightly more to the right and so on, I'm actually truly a person who is not ideologically driven in any way, in that I take each issue at its merit. If you ask me about the death penalty or about immigration, you would think I'm ultra conservative. If you asked me about social issues, trans stuff and gay stuff, you would consider me the most socially liberal person. So I truly am an idea by idea person, and yet I found a lot more of a welcoming platform, if I'm talking about American media, with Fox, whereas a lot of the other media, so for example, if you forgive my own shameless plug, in The Parasitic Mind should not have only been read by viewers of Fox. If anything, it should have been read by the blue-haired folks and the woke people that might be inhabiting MSNBC and NBC and the rest of them, and yet they never ever invite me. And I think it's truly shame, it's shameful that would be the case, because I'm truly not someone who's ideologically driven. I'm a person of science, and yet Fox has always been incredibly kind and hospitable to me, and the other ones have completely ignored me.
And if I'm being real, I think we can do a better job. I know that I can do a better job. You know, I want to host more people on my podcast that disagree with me. I remember the ones who have come on, and I think you and I had an interesting debate about atheism and religion. And, I once had Sid Ziegler of OutSports come on and debate trans issues in sports. I think you can do it in a way. The funny thing, the trick to me is you don't have these conversations with the pretense of kumbaya. Oh, we all get along, there's no judgment, and then at the end we agree. But you also don't have to do it with bad will and coming out with a zero-sum game and an absolute knockout at the end of the match. You know, I think there's a way that satisfies the necessity of entertainment, and that's the truth. This business is about maintaining interest and also the pursuit of the truth.
Got you. I want to close the parenthesis on something we talked about earlier. Is there any hope that you might ever go back to that unfinished book? Maybe this is my psychological need for closure, and I'm living it by proxy through you. I hate the idea that you spent all this time working on this book that never went anywhere. Do you ever envision kind of a fantasy of one day, now that you're much better known, reviving it and at least finding it a home somewhere? Or it's dead, it's gone, we're done?
It's dead, it's gone, we're done.
Why?
And I want to follow up on why. You know, and you said a couple of things interesting right there. First of all, I wrote it when I was 25. Going through probably, what's interesting? I'm 47. So I was probably going through the quarter life crisis before the quarter life crisis was common. Like, what am I going to do with my life and who am I going to be in this world? Yeah. And I wrote this book, a novelization of young men in Austin, Texas, struggling with this exact thing. I think we have an entire generation of people who you have great exposure to through the university system now going through that delayed onset adulthood and struggling with what is way too big of an existential question. What is my purpose? What am I doing in this world? No one should try to answer that question at the age of 25. One should do, not analyze. I think we should be individuals of action, and in the purpose, in that process of action, we find our purpose. But there's something else you said, which is sort of like this OCD completion syndrome, or not the wasted year of investment. I'm like you. Let me tell you something. I start a series, I feel like on Netflix, I just finished Dahmer. Now I'm watching The Watcher. And
I just finished it with my family.
Which one?
The Watcher.
Okay, so I'm on like episode 2, Gad. And you know what? I'm already telling myself, this isn't very good. I'm going to be dissatisfied by the end of this series, and yet I'm going to finish it. And so I want to come back to your review of it and tell me if I'm wasting sure. another investment. But here's what I've learned. I'm like that, and yet I have no regrets about not publishing that novel. I will write a book again, but that year and that process and that work and that journey, and then the other things I got out of that year, I can look back with clear eyes that nothing was wasted, and that novel should be dead and gone.
Well, I because you mentioned the word regret, I'm going to jump to the usually the customary last question I ask some of my guests. But since you kind of set it up for me, I'll do it now. Other than, okay, you don't regret not having finished that book. Are there, and you're still a young man, 47 years old, but as you look back at your life, do you have any other looming regrets? And before you answer it, I always like to explain to my guests the work of one of my former doctoral professors in psychology. His name was, or is, Tom Gilovich. He was a pioneer in the study of psychology of regret. And what he demonstrated is that there are really two sources of regret that people experience. One is due to action and one is due to inaction. So a regret due to action would be, I regret that I cheated on my wife and I was an asshole and now my marriage is dead and I really regret that I did that. A regret due to inaction is I regret that I went into the law because my dad was in law and really what I always wanted to be is a dancer or an artist. and I regret that I never pursued my artistic side. And here I am, 55 years old, and I never lived out that dream. And it turns out, Will, that over the long haul, people's largest looming regret is one typically due to inaction. It's actually yes. something that I talk about in my next book. So having set that up for you, do you have such a regret? And would you be willing to share it with us here?
Yes. And by the way, I would love to see the psychological polling on that. I would guess it has to be over 80%. It may be more overwhelming than that, that most regrets are due to inaction, yes. not to action.
And certainly over the long run, you're exactly right.
So mine are the result of inaction. I have two regrets. And I know these. I've actually in the past 2 to 3 years come to grips with acknowledging that these are regrets. Not that they were big, like, oh my gosh, I can finally admit to myself. But just at this point that I am in my life, I realize these things are going to happen in the most literal sense. So two regrets. And maybe some of this is because of the people I sit on a couch with every weekend on Fox and Friends. Number one, that I didn't serve in the military, that I didn't serve in the United States military. And you know, you're part of this world, Gad, that I'm somewhat part of, where I am lucky enough to get exposure to a lot of really impressive people who led very different lives than mine. These are former Navy SEALs. These are former Army Rangers. These are former Green Berets. These are former just, you know, U.S. military personnel. And it's not just the semblance. It's not just patriotism. It's that. It's not just service. And it is that. It is to be a man of action and to test oneself and to see what one is capable of. And I wish that I would have done that in that arena. In a way, that's why I moved to Montana and worked on a ranch, because I wanted to be and test myself with this life that I didn't have. I mean, I grew up around horses, but I didn't grow up. I didn't grow up blue collar. I didn't grow up, you know, working with my hands. And so I wanted to test myself and live that life and live in that arena more. I wish I would have done the same thing with military service. And the second, maybe even bigger regret, is I didn't have more children. I have two boys, and I love them more. You know, I'm reading this book off and on. I go back and forth with it, but it's Tim Keller, and it's called Counterfeit Gods. He's the Christian pastor, Tim Keller. It's about counterfeit gods. And Gad, you'll love this. And we may have talked about this. And forgive me as I wind. I promise I'll come Please. Back home on these things. I'm so into it. I just rewatched it twice recently. This commencement address by David Foster Wallace, called This Is Water, or What Is Water. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, Gab, but it is amazing. And in it, Wallace says, it's on YouTube, he says, in life, you do not get a choice as to whether or not you worship. You get only a choice as to what you worship. You know, he kind of attaches it to sort of your hierarchy of priorities. And whatever you place at the top of your priorities, your intellect, money, your ambition, love, your beauty, vanity, whatever it is that is number one, whatever wins whenever two priorities are pitted against one another, in essence becomes your God, becomes what you worship. and everything else will lie at the altar of that. And almost every one of the things you choose to worship will betray you. So you might as well consider this higher power who has a pretty strong moral code and an afterlife worth aspiring. That's the argument that Wallace makes. And even in this book by Keller, who talks about counterfeit gods, all these other forms of worship, he talks about loving your children and you know, more so than maybe your faith. You know, I probably run that risk, man, because I love my two boys. I think everything, my world comes down to analogizing how to turn them into men, their sports, their life lessons, their friends, whatever it may be. And I see them approaching the point at which they are going to leave the house. And I think about big families. And so one of my second regret is I didn't have more kids. I wish I had three, wish I had four. I wish I wouldn't have stopped at two. And I'll just end this by saying, maybe this is the lesson of regrets. Regrets don't have to be something that holds you back, but can push you forward. And maybe it won't be literally that I have more kids, or maybe it won't be literally that I get to serve in the American military, but maybe I'll find other ways to serve. And maybe I'll find other ways to build my family. Maybe that's, you know, foster. Maybe that's adoption. Maybe whatever that may be. Maybe it's none of those things. I'm not saying I'm going to do those things, but maybe it's I'll find other ways to build the concept of family and to look for ways to serve.
Well, I certainly share. So let me comment about your two sources of regret. First, the second one. I share that regret in that my wife and I have been together for 23 years. And yet we only have two children, and by we started late by choice. But in retrospect, I would have liked our two children to have been numbers 3 and 4 rather than numbers 1 and 2. The reality is that because we started late, you know, we had our first child when I was 44, our second child when I was 47. Now that's okay. That's a late dad, but my wife is 11 years younger. So there was a bit of leeway, but we sort of took too much time before we got going. So I completely share that regret. And as a more minor regret that I have regarding, you know, parenting issues, is I regret that we did not teach our children all of the languages that we speak. So my mother tongue is Arabic. So I speak Arabic, French fluently, English and Hebrew. We're Lebanese Jews. And my wife also speaks, I mean, French and English, but also she's Lebanese Armenian. So she speaks a fluent Armenian. So between the two of us, we have 5 languages covered. And yet our children only speak French and English. And the reason for that is because if I spoke to them in Arabic or in Hebrew, my wife would be left out of the conversation because she doesn't speak Arabic or Hebrew. And if she spoke to them in Armenian, I would be left out of the conversation. And so we ended up just settling on the two languages that we both know, which is French and English. And I regret that so much because there is such extraordinary power, Will, that comes with being, you know, a pretty deep multilingual person, right? So, I mean, I can get on an Arabic show and talk about Islam in Arabic, and people will start sending me emails and they're like mesmerized by that ability because they know me as Gad Saad, who's the professor who speaks in English. And suddenly I break out the flawless Arabic. There is, and plus it bonds you with people, right? Like, I mean, I could navigate through Arabic milieus, even though, of course, I'm Jewish, but I'm considered a brother because we share a language, right? And so I so regret that I didn't teach them that. Probably you don't have that regret because most Americans regrettably only speak one language, correct?
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
Can I ask you this Please. Question on that? So as someone who speaks so many languages, you talked about the practical applications of being able to do that. I'm curious about the intellectual fluidity that being able to speak so many languages creates. I was hanging out with a very smart friend of mine the other day whose daughter is deaf, and she speaks American Sign Language, and so does he now. And I was talking to him, and she has some other learning disabilities as well, and I was asking him about, you know, where her learning disabilities land on, you know, what age would her intellectual capability be compared to her contemporaries. He said it's difficult to know because American Sign Language is so different, and so when you're interpreting things through language, it's hard to fully communicate or see where someone is processing something. And so he was just telling me, for example, American Sign Language is really stripped down to the basics. And I think I'm not positive about this, but it leads with the noun, always leads with the noun. And it changes the way, I don't know if it changes the way you see the world, but it certainly changes the way you describe the world. And I'm curious if that extends to being multilingual. So in other words, the fact that you can speak Arabic and Hebrew and French and English, you know, has that, whether or not that's through sentence structure, syntax, whatever it may be, Gad, does it change? Does it make you more fluid, actually, not just in how you describe it, but how you see the world?
What a fantastic question. I think that the first thing that comes to mind is the following. There are beautiful expressions in Arabic that you simply don't find the equivalent in any of the other languages. So I will introduce it. First, I will explain what it is in Arabic, and then I'll introduce it to my English audience. And then, because it so well describes a phenomenon. So example, and I remember Greg Gutfeld, whom obviously we both know from Fox, when he first heard me using that Arabic expression, I remember, I think it was on the five, he had sort of used it a few times because it was so poignant. And let me mention it here, and I'm going to bring out a prop. So this is a memory stick. But for a second, assume that it was, I don't know if I'm, maybe I even mentioned it on your show. Imagine it that it's the cork of a wine bottle. And there's an expression in Arabic that says, getting drunk by simply smelling the cork of the wine bottle. I mean, I'm obviously translating, right? And yes, of course, what that means is that you are of weak constitution. Now, when you apply it to cognitive things, if I tell you, you know, Will, you're getting drunk by the cork of the wine bottle in loving Obama, let's say, what basically that says is you're falling prey to the cosmetic features of Obama, but you're not listening to the content of his message. Or if you hate Trump, it's the same thing. You're hating him because of, you know, his cantankerous way of speaking rather than the content of his policies. And so to answer your question, I think what I have found most useful is to take these beautiful expressions that exist in other languages, transport them to English, and then they become part of sort of the gadisms that people know. So here's another one that I may have mentioned on your show because we discussed Fauci, where you'll correct me, you'll tell me if I mention this. There's an expression in Arabic that says, you know, your smell is starting to come out.
I remember this.
Exactly. Yes. And so that one refers to you overextending your stay, right? So we've got these, you know, annoying guests that come over. It's clear that everybody's leaving the party. It's 10 o'clock. And yet here we are at midnight. The kids are yawning. And yet you're still here. Your smell is starting to come out. So there's this great linguistic kind of poetic prose that comes in Arabic that you don't necessarily see in English. So that's probably the most useful link that I found.
Yeah, we have to take, it's interesting, you have to take some very abstract ideas and you turn them into concrete, right? So language is how we make abstract concepts concrete. And truthfully, you could say science is the language there also. Math is a language. It's how we take abstractions. We communicate them in concrete terms to one another. And the same friend was describing to me, can't remember what book he was reading, but he said, it's all subjective. And I was like, come on now, you know, there's objective truth. And he's like, I'm big on objective truth, right? The existence of objective truth. And the existence of objective truth can be there, can be a reality, but in turning it into something that we can concretely discuss and conceptualize with one another, we pick subjective terms.
Right.
That could be Arabic. That could be English. Yeah. He said, for example, let me give you an example. What's the circumference of the United Kingdom? An island, right? What's the circumference? And there's an objective truth. It's a physical feature. It's real. He goes, is it? Is it objective truth? At least in the way we understand it? Because if the scientist chooses miles or kilometers, you're going to come up with one answer. But is that accurate? What if he uses centimeters? And I said, well, it'd just be, you know, however many miles. He's like, no, it wouldn't, because you'd go in every little nook and cranny and you'd come out with a much more precise centimeter circumference of the island. And so the point is, yeah, there's an objective truth, but how we choose to communicate or understand even or describe that truth gets subjective, subjective in terms of language choice, subjective in terms of then you introduce all the other factors of life that can make something subjective.
Well, speaking, since we're talking about language, maybe I could quickly jump to a related point. One of the things that I found that's been that, if I may say, you know, I have the natural skill to do, but many of my academic colleagues regrettably don't, speaking of language and communication, is that if you're going to have a large footprint in media or the public eye as an academic, you need to be able to adjust the style of communication you have for different platforms. So the way that I would speak in a long form chat, whether it be on the Will Cain podcast or the Joe Rogan podcast, is different than when Tucker Carlson invites me and I've got 3 minutes to say, right? So I better not be long-winded. I better not be tangential. I better have my points totally honed in and laser focused. On the other hand, when I appear on, 2 weeks ago, I appeared on, you know, Gutfeld's late night show. That has its own challenges in that you both have to be, you know, professorial and say something of substance, but it's light. It's you know, you have to be, hopefully you can be also funny and engaging. And I think one of the things that is lacking, and I don't think you can train this, you either have it or you don't, is that many academics, while they're very, very good at delivering using whatever language they use to deliver their message within their narrow areas of specialization, once you ask them to step out of that, they're dead. So the guy who can, you know, give a great talk on whatever, you know, chemistry topic that he's interested, you know, that he's an expert in, bring him on Joe Rogan, he's going to implode. It's going to be a disaster. Do you agree that this is a natural skill, or as someone who's in the media, can someone receive media training to greatly improve on those abilities?
That's a great question. And I'm going to harken back to a string I think we left untied just a moment ago when I said the question is whether or not you can teach someone confidence. I'm not saying these two are inextricably related, but as I'll tell you again, as a parent, I ask myself these questions all the time. So what you're describing is a skill or an innate ability in media isn't unique to media. It's just more pronounced. So anybody listening at home right now also goes through the same thing. And we just call it this: read the room, bro. Like, read the room. So any situation you're in, read the room. Like, did you just talk for 10 minutes straight with a group of 7 people sitting around having a beer? Was your story that good? Or did you not see everybody shifting in their seats? Did you not see people losing eye contact, right? Like, we all deal with this on a day-to-day basis in a business meeting, in a one-on-one conference room, whatever it may be. We're all trying to read the room. And so you ask me, is that innate or is that learned? I don't know. I have 2 sons, right? And I'm asking myself, like, you know, look, I come from Texas. One of the I think we can speak. I don't think Fox will get mad at me if I speak bluntly. Like, you know, we say this about guys sometimes. Oh, man, he's got bad bullshit. You know, like that's a problem. Like, you're sitting around the campfire. I just went hunting this past weekend. You don't want to be the guy that's around the fire who's got bad bullshit, you know? And so you go, can that be learned? I want my sons not to have bad BS. I don't know the answer to that. Can you teach confidence? I don't know the answer to that either. I know that I'm trying. But I don't know in the end how much I actually can form on the margins.
I think you can certainly move. If a person is anchored at position X, I can move them plus delta this way or minus delta that way through some sort of media training or, you know, communication training. But, you know, charisma, confidence, I truly, now, of course, many people who are in the consulting game want to convince you that, no, take my seminar and I'll teach you the 1, 2, 3 about how to be charismatic on Joe Rogan. I simply don't. I think that that's a promissory, you know, fool's game. I don't think you can. That charisma, you either have it or you don't. That's the bottom line. Can we switch now? I love very, you know, personal conversations about, you know, your trajectory and so on. I want to talk a bit about football, and then if we have, and soccer, because you're I can't not be talking with the great ESPN, former ESPN sports commentator about football. I know you love the Dallas Cowboys. You know your stuff to talk soccer too, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think so. Every international member of your audience is going to go, oh, great, here comes an American. But I'm cool. Let's do it. Let's throw down on soccer.
And then if we have time, we can do woke stuff. Otherwise, we can leave it off with the sports stuff. So let me tell you a quick story to set up our NFL discussion. 1975, kid escapes from the Lebanese Civil War, moves to Montreal, Canada, that has never seen football before. Pittsburgh is playing Dallas in that Super Bowl. So it happened in 76, but it's the 75 season. So we moved to Canada end of October. I become enamored. Don't ask me how that's possible. I don't come from a football tradition. I'm a soccer guy. I'm from Lebanon. I become enamored with the Dallas Cowboys and specifically Roger the Dodger Staubach. So much so that in retrospect, I look back and I say, my God, how sports can turn us into these tribal creatures where even as a kid who was barely learning how to speak English, I had become so vested in Dallas winning. And I was so upset when Terry Bradshaw defeated them in that first Super Bowl that I saw. So that's our connection first with the Dallas Cowboys. But then I went off that wagon, Will.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry about that. My apologies. I hope we could still be friends.
That was ready for this wonderful moment. Now I'm ready for the turn in the road. Go ahead.
My Danny White, I still stuck with them. But then Joe Montana came in. The flair. And it's not that I'm a you know, fair weather fan that jumps on every winning team. I like aesthetics, right? I like, so for example, today I used, now Drew Brees retired, but I went with the New Orleans Saints for a few years because I love Drew Brees and I love Alvin Kamara. I just love how he moves. And therefore I'm an aesthetics guy.
Okay.
So what do you think? Tell me what you think so far.
I've got a lot of thoughts here. Okay. So first of all, you begin describing one of, if not the most, one of the most things I love about sports, and that is tribalism. Let me explain. Tribalism is a survival tool of humanity, right? It is the way we actually, you and I are sitting here today because of tribalism. We can recognize that and also recognize that tribalism, not unlike confidence, turning into arrogance, turning into narcissism, tribalism can also be very, very problematic. If you draw tribal grounds on race or ethnicity, or gender, or whatever we want to draw our tribal lines, it can manifest into some very ugly human traits. That being said, sports is a cathartic, benign place where we can revert to early tribal instincts.
Exactly.
And I love it. I am from Texas. I believe mostly in geographic tribalism, meaning I am a fan of the Dallas Cowboys, the Texas Longhorns, the Dallas Mavericks. I'm a fan of the Dallas Stars and the Texas Rangers because those are the teams I was born to. Now, my sons were born and raised in New York until the last 2 years, but their father brainwashed them. And that's a fine, fine caveat to this rule. If your father brainwashes you, but the fact that you tribally migrate to the Cowboys is so interesting because it wasn't just happenstance. It was by design. What I mean is Tex Schramm, one of the early leaders of the Dallas Cowboys, designed the uniform to pop on television. That silver. And it doesn't match, by the way. You can see today the pants are sort of a seafoam green, the silvers in the helmet. It's navy blue in the helmet. It's royal blue on the jersey. It's a mess, but it was designed for black and white television to pop.
Nice.
And that star is just so iconic. Add on top of that, you've got Captain America, U.S. Naval Academy graduate Roger Staubach as the leader of this team. You were going to gravitate to that, probably out of a tribal instinct of adopting. You were adopting Canada, not America, but there was probably some values in there underlying the idea of America that you gravitated toward. Then you said you gravitate towards aesthetics. I don't on most sports, and we're going to transition here in a moment. Okay. But I will tell you that the one sport where I didn't have a tribal affiliation, a geographic tribal affiliation, was soccer. So when my sons and I decided to adopt a soccer team.
Thread carefully now.
We vetted carefully. Most of your international audience, which is probably a good chunk of your audience, is going to hate me for it. But we did gravitate towards aesthetics playing a strong role in selecting Manchester City.
Well done. Well done.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, yes. I'm a huge Manchester City fan for aesthetics. More specifically for Kevin De Bruyne.
Oh, Dad, we've never talked about this. That's we've who never... I'm talking about. So first of all, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Please.
I didn't know you were a City fan, by the way. And everybody's going to accuse both you and I of being glory hounds as a result. So I was so
because
excited.
I could have loved Liverpool. I could have loved Liverpool when they won. That's
you could
not
have
true.
Loved Barcelona. You could have chose Real Madrid. You could have chose Bayern Munich. There's a lot of places to search for glory. But I used to make fun of soccer. And this is what a good red-blooded American/Texan conservative is supposed to do, is make fun of soccer. Any game that ends in a 0-0 tie, no game for me.
Right.
But my sons, back to the parenting thing, both got heavily invested in soccer at a young age. It's their sport. So I watch soccer a lot, both amateur, youth, and then English Premier League. And when we were the first time in our lives sports free agents, this was the first time I got to be a fan free agent.
Right.
There were so many things went in. I love powder blue. I just do. So that aesthetic played a role. Yes. I wanted to pick a team, admittedly, that had a shot at being Champions League and winning the Premier League. And I also gravitated to Premier League because it was on TV, as opposed to La Liga or Serie A or Bundesliga. So I'm in England. I'm looking at about 5 to 6 teams that have a real shot. Among those, at the time, I didn't want to be the front runner. So that would have been Manchester United.
Yeah.
That I wouldn't have picked them. Tottenham was sort of the hipster program in New York. Every Brooklyn dude has a Tottenham hat on, so I didn't want to pick that. Liverpool's fine. I eventually, because of, you know, powder blue, but then importantly, Kevin De Bruyne picked Manchester City. And Gad, I love De Bruyne. I might love him more than Luka Doncic, who's the star of my basketball team, Dak Prescott, any of the Texas Long. There is no athlete in any sport that I love watching more than De Bruyne.
Oh, yeah. My respect for you was already here. You've now gone over the threshold. You're in the escape velocity of respect. You know why? Because that means you've got a keen eye, because you're not technically a soccer guy from your childhood. So you it wasn't bred in you straight out of the womb, yet you are exactly recognizing what any person who loves aesthetics gets, right? Because when you first look at De Bruyne, you think, he doesn't have the grace of Messi, who is by definition he's PlayStation, right? He doesn't make sense, Messi, right? He looks a bit maybe, but then you check out his elegance and IQ, right?
That's
whereby
it, right there.
Every single ball that he ever touches, you go, of all possible choices that he could have made, there wasn't one that was better than that one. Therefore, he must be the most, short of Messi. You know, I've seldom seen a player this intelligent. So I'm with you, brother.
So I, of course, I've overthought this out. By the way, my sons, we've talked about it from the beginning. Like, I'm actually gravitating a little bit, Gad, to where my favorite position on the soccer field is the 6, the CDM, because it's even less heralded. And he makes so many passes during the game. And that's the position that was played by Pep Guardiola, the manager of Manchester City. So one of my kids' first soccer coaches, really smart guy, turned me on to this. And I won't belabor it, but there was an American fighter pilot named John Boyd, and he developed the F-16 fighter jet. And he was big on dogfights. And he developed this concept called OODA loop, okay? And I don't know if you've ever heard of this. It's an acronym, OODA loop. Now, that acronym stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. The winner of the dogfight is the one that can loop that process the quickest. So in any fluid game like soccer, this isn't American football, but basketball would be this type of game as well. In a fluid game where the action around you is always changing, not unlike a dogfight in the air, the player on the field that can observe the situation, orient himself on the field, decide, act, and then start again, because the minute you act, you've you've changed the dynamics on the field. So you got to re-engage the decision process. The player that can do that is going to win. I've never seen anybody. And the closest, quite honestly, would be Luka Doncic or LeBron James, who can OODA loop. He's got massive physical traits and athletic advantages, but I wouldn't take away from LeBron. And I dislike LeBron on a lot of, political issues.
Sure.
But he sees the court, but nobody more than De Bruyne. And my analogy is, he's a time traveler. He plays that game 3 seconds in advance of everybody else.
Beautiful. Wow. I love that you're saying all these things. That's why you were an ESPN sports commentator. There you go. I told my daughter, both my kids, I have a daughter and a son. They're both soccer players. I told my daughter, watch De Bruyne, what he's doing off the ball. And so what I told her, and then she learned it. And then she started, I said, look how he's doing. He's looking here. He's looking there. He's taking snapshots of every single possible permutation on the field so that when he receives the ball, when he calls it, he already knows where it's going because he did all those snapshots. And then
therefore he has the ball for the least amount of time. So like a Neymar, everyone gets attention because you can see what he's doing 1v1. But I tell my sons when I'm watching them play, like, I don't actually care if you ever beat anybody 1v1. All I care about when I watch you playing soccer is your head. Is your head doing this, shoulder to shoulder? Are you looking at the field the entire time? That's how I'll know if you're playing well or not.
Exactly. You know, in The Parasitic Mind, in the first chapter, I talk about the importance of freedom. The two guiding, values in my life or pursuits are freedom and truth. But then I wanted to make that point. So it's not just freedom of speech that I care about or freedom of inquiry. Freedom manifests itself in many areas of my life, one of which I'm going to mention now is in soccer. So I used to be a very competitive soccer player who, was heading off to Europe to play professionally and so on. And I played the playmaker position, which is traditionally known as the number 10, even though I didn't wear number 10 typically. And in the Parasitic Mind, I basically mentioned that the importance for me to have a coach who granted me the freedom to float around as I saw fit, to look for spaces, to be creative, determined whether I fit well within that coach and I became, the guy that everybody looked at, or he made me invisible if he were another type of coach where he said, you're playing on the left side of midfield, you have to do this. And it's not because I was a prima donna. It's because my biggest strength, I was a very skillful player. I had a nice touch, but it was precisely this floating around. And so when I see De Bruyne and I tell my kids, watch him. Sometimes, yes, he is a bit more to the right or whatever, but you find him back in defense. Then he's in left wing. Then he's in the center. Then he's just floating around looking for spaces. So that was a manifestation of the importance of freedom to me, even when playing soccer. Don't constrain me, man. You'll decapitate me if you tell me play left midfield. I'm finished. I can't process that.
Right. Well, we share this love, man, because I'll say, I'll cap with this. Both my boys wear number 17.
Oh, is that right? Because of De Bruyne?
Oh, absolutely. Because of De Bruyne.
Very nice. Okay, let's go back to NFL and then we'll try to wrap it up. I know we have a hard stop in 60 minutes. Who do you forget about the Dallas Cowboys? I get the geographic tribalism. Which current team fits our common love for aesthetics in the NFL today? Which is the team that's
most?
I'm gonna guess one. Could it be Kansas City or Buffalo with their high octane offense?
No. So football is such a different game than soccer, and so in essence, you have to boil a game down to its essence to really, I think, play it the way it's meant to be played. I love watching Patrick Mahomes, right? And I'm a University of Texas fan, so we've got our coach is Steve Sarkisian, who came from Alabama, and he's got this high-octane, all-gas, no-breaks offense with now he's got, I'm telling you, the quarterback they have at Texas will be maybe the next Mahomes. But soccer is freedom, as you just described. Soccer, it's funny that people call it communism. It is communal. Soccer is 11 guys working in concert with one another in a very fluid environment. Football is duty-bound. Football is job-oriented. Football is the closest corollary to the military. It's led by generals. It's led by from top down. And its success is predicated on not everybody freelancing, but everybody executing the job that was assigned. You don't want a wide receiver who's just looking to get open. You want a wide receiver that runs the route he's assigned so the quarterback knows he's running that route and can deliver the ball on time. So I'd say Brady is the best distillation of that. There's a reason Brady's won 7 Super Bowls. We'll see if Mahomes, who's way more athletically talented than Brady ever was. But real quick on this, one of my favorite stories is early in his days with the Patriots, Brady ran a play. And, in football as a quarterback, you have progressions, your first read, second read, third read.
Yeah.
He skipped his first read, which was a 10-yard play. It was open and went to the second. And that guy was open for like a 25-yard play. And the offensive coordinator, Charlie Weiss, stopped practice and said, what the hell are you doing, Brady? And he said, well, I saw he was open. Right. And so I went to my second. He goes, that was your first read. Execute your first read. And he goes, but coach, this was a bigger play. And he goes, he took his whistle off and he threw it at Brady. He said, if you want to be the coach, you be the coach. And the lesson there was, there's a reason we're doing everything that we're doing. And there's, I want you to take the profit as designed by the play, and it will add up in a coherent game plan down the road that we win this game. And maybe it's not as flashy or as big as Kansas City, but over a given amount of time, it's won more Super Bowls than anyone else in the history of the game. Both Brady as a player, the Patriots organization, and Belichick as a coach. So if you're asking me, like, what is football supposed to look like? It's supposed to look like what the New England Patriots were under Tom Brady. And it evolved. You have to be able to evolve over time. That's Saban at Alabama as well. You start out with like a run-oriented offense. As it gets bigger, you become more of a pass-oriented offense. So it's not without innovation, but it's designed as this military-esque hierarchy of doing your job, which, by the way, was Belichick's famous chant, do your job.
Very cool. In terms of players on the aesthetic scale, are you with me on Alvin Kamara?
Well, it's funny. I've watched Alvin Kamara, but he's never stood out to me like that. I mean, he's athletic. He's fast.
Forgive me for interrupting you. Superman, Dean Cain, right? I'm trying to remember. He shares your last name. Yes. I had him on my show. What a lovely guy. Do you know him well? Do you know him well?
I met him a few times on Fox.
What a gentleman. And he used to be an ex-football player. And so we were talking and I shared with him my admiration of Kamara. And he turned me to the YouTube clips where you see Kamara doing his training regimen. Have you seen those?
No.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
I think I did see one of those one time.
You know, he's kind of blindfolded, semi-blindfolded.
Yes, I did see. He's catching balls in the air as well.
Catching balls, red. Yeah. But that captures his balance, the way he moves. The only player I've seen, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that moves this gracefully was arguably my favorite running back of all time, Barry Sanders, who had this both ability to be powerful, break through the hole, but also do all the, you know, the jive stuff, the shimmy stuff. And please pay attention more to Alvin Kamara and let's try to see.
Noticed Barry Sanders and Kamara as much. I think more when I see Kamara, I think slashing. Sanders was a little like joystick Frogger, just, you know, bump, 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 bump all over the field. Like, you know who is the closest to Sanders to me in terms of athleticism and the way they move on the field? Messi.
Yes. Very true.
Those two resemble each other on the field.
So true. So true. Okay. Last question and then I'll let you go. Are there any projects that you're currently working on that you'd like to use this small platform? I don't have the Fox platform, but whatever platform I have a lot of dedicated fans that you'd like to talk about before we wrap it up.
Well, I appreciate that opportunity. You can always check me out on Fox and Friends weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 6 to 10 Eastern. The project that also has that maintains my passion is the podcast video and audio where Gad Saad appeared not long ago. Because I do love these long form conversations. I do love the tangents, as you talked about earlier. I think that's where all the juice is in a conversation. I think that's the mark of good bullshit. And and so whether it's on YouTube or Fox News podcast or Apple or Spotify, I would love it if your listeners would check out the Will Cain podcast.
You are such a delight. Stay on the line so we could say goodbye offline. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Will. I look forward to hopefully hosting you again.
Thank you again.
Cheers, buddy.